This month, marking our podcast's second anniversary, we welcome Maria Miles, author of Di Arcano Rosario Lune, on the secret of the Lunar Rosary. Maria is a professional diviner and talented cartomancer operating from Seattle's Edge of the Circle books. In this month's episode, we discuss Maria's pamphlet, available now from our Guides to the Underworld series, the nature of the Lunar Rosary she has formed from her engagement and practice with the magic of the Picatrix, specifically by engaging with the Lunar Mansions, charting their evolution from their Arabic expression through to the truly ancient sources in India. I am your host, Matt Hadfield, and it is with great pleasure that I welcome Maria Miles to the Hadean Press podcast. Hello, Maria. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Matt. It's great to be here.
So we are here to discuss your wonderful pamphlet, Di Arcano Rosario Lune, on the secret of the Lunar Rosary, part of Hadean's Guides to the Underworld series. This pamphlet describes a highly practical and meditative magical object, which also serves as a microcosmic astrological map for the sorcerer. But before we get into all of that, would you like to introduce yourself to our audience and tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into magic and the occult?
I think like many of us, I've been kind of fascinated about this my entire life. I had kind of a hippy-dippy mom a little bit back in the 90s when I was born. And so I had some kids' books on like sun signs and a couple others that I remember kind of taught me a little bit about just inherently spiritual things from a non-Christian perspective. And that was probably the first little doorway in. I think I remember being able to be like, oh, I'm a Libra, and that means blah, 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 from like age like 9 or 10 or something like that. But I got more into the occult in my teenage years. And I remember having like a shopping spree one time when I was 18 and ordering copies of like the Peterson Grimorium Verum. I had a copy of the A.E. Waite's big white book on ceremonial magic and black magic and stuff like that. I found that at a bookstore I worked at actually when I was a teenager, and that was like a take home one day. So yeah, that was kind of how it all began. And then in my early 20s is when I got into traditional astrology, and that is where I discovered the Picatrix specifically, which became the main source that I used for the material that I wrote on in my pamphlet.
Yeah, and I think we're going to touch on the Picatrix a little bit later on as well. Was there any defining moment in your initial exploration of the occult and magic that made you think, oh, this is something real? This isn't something that I've just read about in books, but this is something that has an actual effect on my life in a real objective sense.
Yeah, I think there was a silly little money drawing spell that I had work on a day at work that had been very, very slow. And then suddenly I had, and it was a very chaos magic-y kind of like thrown together slapdash attempt at it. But I think a lot of people kind of have that fool's luck at the beginning of their practice that kind of makes them go, oh, okay, this does work. This is worth like looking more into. And then, you know, it kind of goes from that to, okay, well, maybe I can try summoning demons and talking to them, or things like that. Like, you just try to push the envelope a little bit more and more. Okay, now that I think about it, there was also an invocation of Jupiter that I did, I think, using kind of like I had a Crowleyan phase like a lot of other people too. But having a massive thunderstrike at the height of the invocation, which thunder is very rare in the Pacific Northwest. It does not happen very often. And so when you have weather react to your magic in ways that are alien and strange for your biome, I would say that is kind of one of those things where I go, oh, okay, that wasn't just happenstance. That was something reacting to what I'm doing.
To really understand the content of your pamphlet, we need to start by exploring some of the history and the concepts which underpin its content. So let's start with the Lunar Mansions. Could you describe something about them? What are they? How do they fit into astrology?
Yeah, well, they're a 28-fold division of our zodiac. They were very tied with the fixed stars a bit more than the solar zodiac is, right? So the 28-fold division too, they're not quite as even as like the signs of 30 degrees each and things like that. And they were demarcated by specific stars as well. And we see that in the Arabic names for the manziles or mansions, where their names are drawn from the stars that are thought to be the boundaries of each mansion. The moon passes through each of these mansions about one per day. The moon is the fastest of the stellar bodies, right? Like if we look at like the Chaldean order of the planets, right? So we have Saturn the slowest all the way down to the moon the fastest. So the moon's passage through these, I think, was a very easy thing for humans to grasp onto. They're kind of fascinating because we see them also talked about in a number of different areas too, from like the nakshatras in Vedic astrology, the menziles in Arabic astrology. We see the lunar mansions also mentioned in like Tibetan astrology, various other forms of it. So we see it repeated again and again, though there are slight differences and changes. The division is fascinating as well because it is so tied to the fixed stars who govern us. Well, the lunar mansions are a 28-fold division of the zodiac that we can draw back originally to ancient India, where we find the nakshatra system. This division is fascinating as well because it is so tied to the fixed stars who govern us, who govern the parameters of the mansions themselves, and their names even coming from these stars that mark them. And then we find that in various, and even like there are two different systems given in the Picatrix, for instance. It's said that different mansions have different qualities. Then there's even things like the seasons of the moon or the phases, well, we call them the phases of the moon, but the ancients thought of them in terms of seasons as well. So there are lots of different, rather complicated, combinations of them. The mansions have in some way they some of they do have images associated with them, but also there seems to be a lot of use of them as kind of for just electional choices in as far as, oh, you do such and such an activity in this mansion. You'll see that repeated throughout many descriptions of the mansions. So it's another strange. I mean, you kind of find this if you study traditional astrology. There just is more than one way to skin a cat. This is just one of those ways, I guess.
And so, what is the importance of the moon itself in this 28 division structure?
Well, I think because the moon is the second brightest object in our sky and its cycles are so noticeable, it could be assumed its import was impressed upon our ancestors from time immemorial. As one of the luminaries, her light and movements clearly bring boundaries and definition to our world through her cycles alongside those of the sun. So To go even more in depth on this, we can look at how she is seen as a gateway for us in the sublunary world to the influences of the higher astral powers. She is the one who disperses the rays of the other planets upon her realm, and so her movements and relation to the other wanderers was of utmost importance to the ancient astro mages who gave us the works of that us moderns draw upon. She was an intermediary, I guess we could say, in a lot of ways, right? Kind of a creative matrix for the other astral powers as well. And I think it's interesting too, because you'll see that idea repeated in a lot of magical texts, even down to like the the Greater Key of Solomon and some of the lunar pentacles and things like that, with like control over doorways and things like that, or ability to unlock things.
So, what is the sublunary realm? What does it look like from the perspective of somebody practicing the magic of the Picatrix?
Right. So the sublunary realm would be like our lower world that we live in, the world from which we perceive all of these other things happening above us. It's kind of the world that gets sewn out of all the little bits and pieces of these different energies and threads that get kind of drawn by each of the different kind of celestial powers, right? So, I guess plain and simple, it's our world as we look up upon the moon itself, right? It looks down upon us.
And the moon is that intermediary, as you mentioned, between us and the celestial.
No, exactly. And so if we were like looking to at like spirit models, then like the spirits or angels of the moon would be like the intermediaries of like our workings to higher spirits. So even if we are doing astrological magic, say for like Jupiter or Saturn or Mars, we would still rely heavily upon the moon. The moon is like one of the most important parts of an electional chart because we need things to run smoothly, right? We kind of need our intent to be relayed upwards in this model. So I would think I would say that, yeah, her spirits, which maybe even more effective to think of these, the planets in these ways as not being like, oh, the moon, like that big object you're seeing in the sky, but really as like that battalion of spirits that are the lunar spirits that go and do these things, right? So that may be even a little bit more effective. Like you're not actually asking the big hard rock in the sky, but instead the spirits that are attached to those ideas to aid you.
Okay, and do these 28 mansions of the moon, do they map in any way to the 12 signs of the zodiac? Is there any kind of sympathy or coherence with the way that they map to one another?
Yes, although they are kind of uneven in their division of the 12 signs, but there are I would say that they are connected particularly through the equinoctial and solstitial signs. So you will find like rather larger menzil at the start of each of those, right? And those points in the zodiac seem to be the largest crossover and connection between the lunar zodiac and the solar zodiac.
The celestial crossroads, as it were.
Yeah, exactly.
So we've touched on it a little bit already, but could you describe something of the Picatrix? And it seems to be one of the major influences on you and in on your work. So could you tell us a little bit about its history and its origin?
Well, it's a very important text, I would say, not just in astrological magic, but in magical texts as a whole. This strange Arabic grimoire is full not just of instructions on magical workings, but also full of aphorisms of the philosophy the authors seem to subscribe to. So reading it really gives you an idea of what exactly the author was drawing upon, and also the kind of view of the world they were trying to carve out and use as a model, I guess, for how all of these things work. Along with the plentiful description of stellar images, it also has chapters filled with strange concoctions made of various things that would either poison someone or make them sick. So it's kind of clear that the instructions were likely written in some kind of code. Like an uneducated person would maybe just go and try. There are multiple actual instructions that if you just followed it to a T would kill you in there. So you really like need to at least know, oh no, you shouldn't do exactly that. They're describing something else through that name. So there's a lot of that, which does make it kind of hard. I'm not sure if, I mean, literally, like some of these concoctions are things that are made up of like different amounts of like animal blood or like animal heads and things like that. And it has me very much wondering if there's really any way to kind of crack some of those codes, or if maybe they were just put there as a litmus test to kind of weed out people who would kind of go rushing in without not fully realizing that what they're about to do is dangerous.
There is that element as well of it being a, and I, please chip in and give more information on this as you feel necessary. But it's founded on an Aristotelian perspective of the universe,
Right.
and the virtues of many of the plants and gory animal components probably have celestial correspondences or used to in some way. So once you read, for instance, like the brain of a cat or whatever it is, they're often quite gory ingredients, but there's that potential that maybe the cat itself has this virtue in, some ancient collection of texts at some point that was then drawn upon by the author, who assumed that the celestial sympathies would be in coherence with the materia used in the spell.
Right. No, exactly. So yeah, no, he does the author does seem to be drawing upon a somewhat coherent worldview that is like based in like you pointed out, kind of an Aristotelian worldview, but like mixed in with then all sorts of strange things. I also know from having studied some practical alchemy with a teacher who has actually been studying, practicing this for a while, that there definitely are, kind of coded ways of putting things in. I know, for instance, that like my teacher's teacher in the tradition kind of trolled Israel Regardie and almost caused Regardie to poison himself with antimony. Because he just was not getting the very literal, you're working with lead. There are kind of these aspects where I'm like, well, yeah, I don't know how much of this can ever really be regained. So some of those things, like the yucky animal brains components, I'm like, I'm sure there was a reason for that, but I'm unsure if we can recover that personally.
So how about so I've done this a lot in my own work, but for instance, when you do encounter such materia in, for instance, like the Greek magical papyri or the very ancient texts, how do you go about substituting or finding alternatives for these unusual or exotic or even dangerous substances?
Well, so far okay, to be honest, so far I have not tried to really do any of the workings that have used things like that per se. However, when I did make one of the first talismans I made from the Picatrix was an image of Venus, and I tried to follow the instructions for making the planetary images as best as I can. However, I could not get the blood of a dove. However, there were pigeons in Seattle, and I was like, well, I could just catch a pigeon. And I'm like, I really don't know how to do that, and or don't know how I'd feel about doing that. So I just got feathers. I collected feathers of a pigeon and I burnt them down to an ash, and I used that instead. So that's probably the closest I would say I've gotten to having to substitute one of those things. And so it still had the material of virtue of like coming from that animal, but it wasn't necessarily the exact same thing.
I feel that at this point we really should have a warning or some kind of statement attached to this specific interview, because the Picatrix itself does possess a lot of dangerous materials. And please do not try this at home unless.
No, I think that would probably be very wise. A lot of the stuff I drew from the Picatrix for my booklet too, luckily does not contain anything that we're going to have to substitute dangerous things or possibly cause the reader to have to go and behead a cat or something like that.
Please don't hurt or harm any animals.
Yes, especially cats. I'm gonna say that, just especially cats, please.
Yeah, I agree. As I mentioned, the Picatrix was one of the primary inspirations for your pamphlet, but have you drawn on any other specifically Arabic sources?
Yes, there was some material on the mansions from the Shams al-Marif that I did draw from, as far as they kind of had just their own descriptions of the mansions, but they had as well the natures of the mansion, so the fiery, humid, hot, cold, those things. But also too, there were the different fortunes of the mansions that I found in there, as well as the different Arabic letters attached to them, since there are 28 letters in the Arabic alphabet. And so that was another thing I drew upon. The fortunes and natures of the mansions, I included that specifically to help with people with well, to help augment a specific prayer that I used for doing the ro Lunar Rosary itself, and that I include in the description of how to do it in the pamphlet as well. And so that was the main thing. So it wasn't incredibly heavy, though I will say the material in Shams al-Marif is another source to look at, though it does differ significantly in some ways from the Picatrix. And even in the Picatrix, there are two separate systems of the lunar mansions and their qualities and what you use them for, images for them, and things like that. So it does seem like n not everyone quite agreed in the ancient world of which one was what, so that does lead to a lot of exploration that one can do.
That's something else we should really mention as well, and I because it's something that I really like to drive home, is that there isn't one specific correct interpretation. Even of modern Western astrology, there are several different interpretations. So it's always good to broaden your perspective and really read around the subject, so you can sort of enhance what you already understand by, exploring other systems and learning from other systems. So it's material like this that you've presented in your pamphlet, which I think is really interesting and really useful for a lot of people who might not be aware of the more Arabic side or the Arabic influences and that. But you go even further than the Arabic in this, because you trace some of these astrological concepts even further back through to India.
And that's also evident in even in Picatrix. The author clearly references time and time again, such and such was attributed to the Indians, and there and back again. And I wanted to also say that in the history of astrology and it traveling from east to west and back again. Some really interesting things did happen there because, like, the mansions moving from India to Persia to the rest of the Arabic world, then to and then into Europe, right, eventually. But even in the process of entering the Arabic Persian world, some of that stuff went back to India again and later in the Middle Ages. And you see this in kind of the different schools of astrology that kind of developed in different regions in India, like the ones that were closer to Persia, for instance. You see this again, like things going east, things going west, things going east. And you kind of notice these cycles happening over and over and over again. It's kind of, yeah, it's one of those things that kind of fascinates me. Again, there's kind of like, there's no one true, pure school of astrology. It's been going back and forth for so long. It's impossible to really separate them, too.
Yeah, highly worth studying.
Exactly. Exactly.
So you mentioned at the beginning of your pamphlet that the eight voces magicae connected to the moon found in book 3, chapter 9 of the Picatrix are, to quote, explained as differentiated within the root or coadunating names. That's a new word for me. means many different things coming together. So these names, which contain the others, which are attributed to the six directions and the spirit of movement and progress through the zodiac. These seven are all contained within the root name, and therein lies a tremendous secret. So I'm good. I really want to ask you to elaborate on this further. Is this in any way connected to, say, gematria or a form of gematria, or is it connected to letter magic? What's going on here in this section?
I will be honest and say I would not be able to really look at, I would need to be able to look at the original language that those names would have been written in to kind of actually figure out if that's the case. I'm wondering if it is something that the author had just picked up and then repeated again, since these names, both in like the both in that chapter, and I also noticed there is a connection in the Picatrix between the chapter nines of book three and book four, because in book three, chapter nine, they talk about the name, the eight names of the spirits of each of the planets. And then if you go and look in book four, chapter nine, they have the prayers to the spirits of those planets, and the prayers are made up of kind of, yeah, the barbarous words of evocation kind of things that appear to be just variations of the names described in book three, chapter nine. So, like, for instance, the prayer to the lunar spirits being Guernus, Hedus, Marinus, Miltas, Tamex, Ranix, Maelus, Degeus, Moon, come swiftly with your spirits. But those names, Guernus, Hedus, Marinus, Miltas, Tamex, Ranix, Maelus, Degeus, they would really appear to be either slight, like with very slight variations. They would be variations of the names given in chapter book four, chapter nine. We have Harnus, Hades, Mareus, Melitas, Times, Heus, Menelaus, Dahanus, and I always found it fascinating too that there's like the spirit of the progress through the signs, so it kind of creates this like almost like a stop motion speed. Like I always thought of it as being like, so is this like the animating spirit that kind of shows the progress through?
This is what I was going to say, because this sounds to me very much like this is a spirit which is animated It's animating. It's these names that the projecting it in the six directions of movement, and then you also have this other name which brings them together, and then you have a name which encompasses the entire group, which leaves you with eight. So it gives you this idea of like a three-dimensional animated being, a collection of beings moving through the celestial sphere. Yeah, it's really fascinating.
Yeah, no, that was something that when I noticed that connection between particularly those two chapters, and then between the names of the spirits, of the directions and movement paired with the spirit names given in the prayer to the lunar spirits, I was like, okay, so these things are connected, these things all wrap together. What do you do with that? Because there is no real explanation of what you are supposed to do with that in the Picatrix. I think it was kind of assumed that, oh, well, there's spirits. You should know what to do with spirits. And that was what kind of gave me the idea for doing this, essentially like a meditative practice using the Lunar Mansion as the grounding point, right? So the lunar mansion the changes once per day, right? The moon moves very fast. And then not just that, but the Picatrix also gives a list of the names of the spirits who rule each of the mansions. So then you get a ninth name. And so that ninth name would also be traded out each day. Right. So, like the prayer to the lunar spirits would remain the same, but adding the name of the lord of the mansion of that day. And so the meditation would be based in basically trying to, the point of it being you're attuning yourself and your psychic body, your auric body, what, how, your subtle body, however you want to describe it in whatever system, but that energy body that is, cohabitating with us, right? To not just the movement of the moon, but to the movement of the moon spirits. And then also their qualities, because each of these mansions and their mansion lords have different qualities than two. And yeah, no, I part of the reason too, I think that I talked about it in this way where like there's a tremendous secret here was kind of because I thought of it as this the one name that brings them all together. It kind of brings all those spirits present at once, like the snap of a finger. In Vajrayana, for instance, the mantra of the deity is said to be one and the same as the deity. So anywhere you pronounce the mantra of a deity, that deity is present. And that was the same kind of thinking that I was approaching this with, that, well, call the spirit, sit with the spirit, move forward from there. Yeah, no, because the because that just that really fascinated me when I discovered that. And I like not just the connection between those two particular chapters, but then also the names of the Lunar Mansion lords in and of themselves. That kind of was like the personalized key to each of them, so that you're like, ah, okay, it's my in card, I guess, right? And like even in the pamphlet where I explain like the use of the prayer to the lunar spirits, you would start with Guarnus, Hedus, Myrnus, Miltos, Tamix, Rannix, Maelus, Degeus, Moon, come swiftly with your spirits. Oh, and so say that the lunar mansion, it was the first mansion. So it would go, O fiery Gares, unfortunate lord of the first lunar mansion, El Sharitain, the two signs, open your mysteries unto me and reveal your secrets, initiating me. And so doing that each day, right, with a different, and so you'd substitute, like, like depending on if that mansion is fortunate, unfortunate, if it's hot and fiery, if it's cold and earthy, just trading those things out and but following along the course of the 28 beads, doing that prayer, doing that meditation each day, would kind of align one's subtle body with just the very subtle movements of the planet through the mansions, and then also from one spirit to another too. So again, going back to the moon as like intermediary, it's kind of like she's bringing you along to meet each of the spirits in each of their mansions. It's kind of like having like a tour of friends' homes with that one friend who knows everyone.
I love it. Yeah, I love it. It's intermediary and animated. So it's wonderful. And it's definitely a rich area, I think, to apply, for us to consider applying to our work, especially if we work with planetary magic or celestial magic. Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. So, moving on to the object itself, the crux of of your pamphlet, the Rosarium Lunae. You go to great lengths to describe the manner in which it should be constructed, even detailing the specific stones to be used, stating that you came to understand all of this in a vision. Could you describe something of how this was accomplished and why you believe the virtues of these specific stones have a coherence with the lunar mansions?
The creation of the rosary itself was a particularly spirit-led process. The first time I had tried meditating on the name of the first mansion lord, plus the names of the lunar spirits, and as I recited them, I beheld a vision of a string of pale, shining gemstones. And it occurred to me that a rosary of 28 beads would be a simple thing to make. I wanted to find gemstone beads that matched what I saw in the vision, because it was a very, very interesting thing to behold, just how particularly bright and shiny, very fine white as well. So I really just kind of started searching out beads that resembled what I saw. And I ended up choosing snowy quartz, which I used four large snowy quartz beads, like larger than the others, and these are kind of like the dividing beads. And then the smaller beads were mother of pearl, which is very, it literally looks almost like the face of our moon in many ways. And then rainbow moonstone, which is both like white but also kind of translucent as well. And so these three together just very much, I felt kind of really captured. I also, again, I like the sacred number three, and going back to my alchemical training as well, and the three principles of sulfur, mercury, and salt. kind of thinking of these as a these beads and their appearances as being symbolic of that as well, because these are the three principles that all things are made up of in different gross and finer qualities. The choice of beads mainly was just it looked like what I saw in the vision while I was meditating, but then I went with three and divided, and then had four septenaries. So having those four larger beads dividing the rosary into four groups of seven each. So there was some, numerology choices made there. And then the three kinds of beads, same thing. Just I kind of wanted to use just the sacred numbers, I guess, just for balance, and it just feels very grounded in that way. It doesn't feel all that random to me.
So I brought it up because specifically Hadean doesn't really work a lot with material that's based on visions and what I imagine what we would call personal gnosis. But the idea that you have applied it to create this object, which is then used in ways which do hold sympathies and do hold specific coherences, especially when used in the specific way with say the spells of the Picatrix. This is like a really interesting and a really perfect example, I think, of applied sorcery, applied magic.
Right.
Not simply just that, oh, I saw it in a vision and then did it. It's I studied, I applied my knowledge, I had an experience, and then I used that to create something. And it wasn't just something that did nothing, it's something of value. So just for that alone, I think it's really interesting to spotlight this and make a point out of it. Really interesting stuff.
No, I like that you pointed that out because, yeah, no, that is exactly, I mean, how I even came, how I made the first rosary for myself. It all came from just like first I discovered the written material, the names of the spirits, the prayers to the lunar spirits, and then I just tried out using it like a mantra. I think the first time I did it, I just used a regular mala, just to count. And I will even say it's kind of interesting that like 27, a typical standard mala is 108 beads. Traditionally, too, you consider each mantra really just 100 re repetitions. Like the extra beads are because you probably messed up somewhere along there. But still, the 28 beads of the Lunar Rosary, I was like, oh, it's basically one quarter of a standard mala almost, give or take like one bead, which I think is kind of funny. But then, yeah, going from like it wasn't just like, I just go, oh, it'd be really cool to do this. It was, I tried actually meditating using like these specific, spirit names and using them as a mantra. It had an effect. I then took it a step farther and made something based on something I had seen because of that. And then by the time I actually got the written manuscript to, Erzsébet, I think I had been practicing it daily for like a few months. And I really just I wanted to test it out for a long time before even putting it out there because I was just so afraid of like, I don't know, leading people astray or this maybe not actually being all that useful. But in the end, I did find that one, I think meditation of any kind is just helpful. It is just helpful. It is good for you. But then from on a magical side of things, I did notice that it seemed to bring some depth in my own personal experience of making some stellar images, because I will say that some of my experiences with astrological magic is it can be rather dry. Like wait to a certain time, carve this image into a rock or a sheet of metal, bing, bam, subfumigate it with a specific scent, bing, bam, boom. There you go, you're done. And while I've done a lot of that, I will also say the astrological workings that were the most meaningful to me were the ones where I think I dug in a little bit more and tried to not just ground myself in the moment, because really that's the funny thing about astro magic is you're like trying to capture a single moment in the scale of the universe to make something happen, right? So if you can if you can kind of ground yourself in that even further, it can add an extra oomph to it. But yeah, I also thought even beyond that, it just kind of added some extra depth to exploring one's own personal, magical cosmos, right? Because each of us is looking out at all these other things. So each of us is constantly going through this separate, different journey than everyone else. So it's just a way of exploring that a little bit further, I guess.
Yeah, excellent. Really good stuff. You make mention here as well, you have done several times on social media, that there's a real importance to the manner in which the moon is not only understood to be waxing or waning, but that its speed through the heavens is also of great importance. Could you explain what does that mean, the speed of the moon?
Well, the speed of the moon especially can have negative or positive effects on a talismanic election because it can either bring things about swiftly or pretty much negate the intended work by moving too slowly. A slow moon is counter to her very nature as the fastest moving planet of the planets. So a slow moon is really an absolutely terrible impediment. I mean, it's just counterintuitive to her nature. Luckily, this kind of happens at certain times in her cycle, even within, her own like nearest and farthest ranges from our Earth, right? So there are like astronomical ways of calculating when this happens, right? But it is really important if one is especially wanting to experiment with astro magic to any successful degree that they pay attention to things like the speed of the moon, because a slow moon will kill a talisman or a petition to those spirits as well. So
For our audience who are listening, how, for instance, could they work out how best to time this? So, for instance, I'm making myself a talisman, and the moon is waxing, and it's waxing in the correct region of the sky, it's in the right mansion. What kind of tools could I use, for instance, to work out whether or not that this waxing moon in the correct part of the sky is at the correct speed?
right, using a text like an ephemeris would be helpful for just taking note of like what the moon's speed is over the course of that time that you have open to you for the election. That would probably be the quickest and easiest way to look such a thing up.
And do you have any advice for people who might have absolutely no idea how to do that? Because, I've cracked open an ephemeris and you look at it, it's just numbers and symbols, and oh my God, how do I even begin to interpret this? So, do you have any pointers for people who might never have done that and might, need, or are there any other like shortcuts maybe on the internet that,
Oh yeah, there are plenty of like apps and as well as websites for astrological stuff that will have information on that. You'll be able to find the speed of the moon rather easily just with a quick Google search. Yeah, no, thankfully we have technology to help us. I do get a kick out of sometimes just reading if my ephemeris and being like, oh no, but yeah, that's also kind of weird, I think, for like the average person to like crack open a book just full of numbers and go, oh yes, this is meaningful.
yeah, they're pretty useful. I would recommend you get one and learn how to read one. But okay, and my final question to you about specific astrological intricacies is, how much does the period of time known as Via Combustor factor into the process in which you work with the lunar mansions? This is the period where the moon is between 15 degrees of Libra and 15 degrees of Scorpio, and it's known as a particularly malevolent time, because of the virtues specifically of both Mars and Saturn are at their height. And I'm just curious if for those for people who are listening and that who are attempting to juggle all of these Arabic sources, because the Via Combustor is a part of one of the Arabic lots. How do all of these ideas fit together, and does it play any role specifically in your interpretation of the mansions?
So I guess it really kind of would just depend on what you are hoping to use it for. So I would say that it would be really useful if you were using the Lunar Rosary, for instance, just to for the meditative practice and to become acquainted with each of these sectors of the moon's home in the sky, right? So that could actually be very useful to meditate upon the lords of the mansions that are thought of as being not so good for the moon, right? So that could be useful, or at least worth an experiment and kind of seeing how those influences play out in one's own experiments. I wouldn't say that I've factored much into using those in any way, like for making talismans or things like that. I would still stick to the traditional rules, but
Oh, I would definitely say do not make any talismans during that period of time. Is
No.
not unless it's a curse that you're trying to make.
Yeah. Oh, yes. No. There. And so there are some people who really love making those, and that would be a good time for that. But
Don't make it in your home.
yeah. Yes. Exactly. And don't carry it on you, for
Don't
God's
carry on.
sake. So, yeah. But I would say that. Yeah. While I did not factor that into when I was experimenting and creating the Lunar Rosary to start with, it would be an interesting thing to basically make some sessions out of actually paying attention to your meditations when you reach those points in the mansions themselves.
Okay. All right. Well, we've talked a lot about how the Rosarium Lunae can be utilized in meditation. Does it have any other practical applications outside of that? For instance, in working spells, for instance, or conjuring spirits with the mansions?
I did, yes, I would say that it does. I found it very helpful for calling for bringing the spirits to be more present. But then also I've done some very kind of, I'm big, I especially at the time that I had created the Lunar Rosary, I was very big on experimenting with things. In particular, I would say I would love to do some more experimentation on how it can be used in weather magic, because the moon is so very connected to the weather in a lot of different ways. But I did have some success at the time, because I was living in Las Vegas at the time that I was doing a lot of these experiments, and I had some tremendous fun with stirring up small storms into like a monsoon and things like that. And I would say that there definitely are practical effects, because again, the sublunary spirits are going to be the closest spirits to us. It definitely seems to draw them in very quickly, very easily. I also have to say that when I combined the practice of the Lunar Rosary with making images for specific mansions, I would sit and do a session on that mansion before then making an image for that mansion. So that I found very helpful and useful. So there's a lot of different things left to experiment with. In just how this could be used. I think there are a lot of practical uses for it beyond just the meditative. However, also, I mean, I'm a little bit biased in kind of thinking, well, actually, you can use meditation very practically, and especially for working with spirits, because they seem to really notice when we slip into those states of mind. I am not sure why, but that there does seem to be, like, they notice that. They notice when we put in that work. And I would really like to see an experiment with some more ways that this could be done, other than just, messing with storms, because that's always just been a fascination of mine, and that could be its own whole conversation, is the funny stories of the times I'm fairly certain I've made things worse. But that may not always be so practical, but when it comes to things like droughts, I could see that being terrifically, terrifically useful. And especially in the recent years, living here in the Pacific Northwest, almost every summer ends with a rather longish drought here. And so it would be probably worth it for me to experiment with more of this weather magic, simply so that we don't, simply because I really hate drought season.
So maybe go and use it to contact some undines and make some pacts with some water elementals. Very interesting, very useful stuff, I think there.
Well, I even too, when I made my first batch of them, when I consecrated them, I surrounded them in kind of a little bed made up of sheddings from a white snake. And I wanted because it was white, I was like, ooh, lunar stuff. But then also because the snake spirits, the Nagas, they are water spirits. They're the ones who control the rains and stuff. So that's something else that pops into my mind where I'm like, well, this could also be a way of kind of blending in some stuff there as well. Though that would be, yeah, take some experimentation and also maybe do that delicately.
And so you brought up there that you made your first batch of these Rosarium Lunae. So are you selling these objects, or do you make them? Are they available if people are interested in buying them?
Not at this current point, though I am planning on doing that in the near future, because I have had people reach out and ask me if I have them available. It is something that I would like to do within 2025 is start having more batches available and putting those on my website.
Excellent. And where can people find you and your work?
Yeah, they can find me either on Instagram at Rooted Stars Astrology, or you can find me at my website, rootedstarsastrology.com.
And finally, I guess, is there anything that you're currently working on or that you're really excited about, something that you're obsessed with right now?
Right now, well, the main thing that I do is I am a professional fortune teller, so I'm a tarot reader and a cartomancer who works out of Edge of the Circle Books here in Seattle, Washington. I also take clients online as well. I'm kind of always working because it's kind of a grind to get this stuff done. But yeah, I've especially too because I've been reading tarot since I was 13. I'm 32 now, so almost 20 years. I've been reading professionally since my early 20s, which is also when I got into Picatrix. So it's kind of funny that all like around age 21 is when all this stuff began kind of coming together. So I've been reading for about professionally for about a decade. I've been reading in the same store for about 4 years now. And yeah, that is the main thing I focus on. I do take clients online as well, so if anyone was interested in getting either a card reading or a natal chart or solar return reading, I take clients online and people can reach me via my website where they can email me to book me. And aside from that, I do have a couple ideas for future writing projects. One is a book on psychic self-care and psychic self-defense, kind of updating things a little bit more for the modern readers. And also making something a little bit more wide range, like lots of people will be interested in that. But I have had multiple people email me if I will write any more on the Lunar Rosary. So I am kind of considering what more I can do writing about this subject and maybe returning to that in a future work as well. Maybe writing something on cartomancy as well would be a good idea. So basically, I'm just either telling fortunes in a shop or I'm thinking about the different writing projects I should be starting.
That's all excellent. And I'm really looking forward to seeing some more from you in the future, especially if it's something to do more again with this rosary or with cartomancy, because I think you have a very interesting perspective on that. And that's something else that we could get into in the future if you want to come back on the show sometime.
Oh, I
But
would love to.
thank you so much for coming on today and talking to me. I've had a really good time.
Yes, thank you so much, Matt, for having me on.
That was Maria Miles, author of Di Arcano Rosari Lunae, on the Secret of the Lunar Rosary, a deeply informed text of lunar magic available from Haydean Press's Guides to the Underworld series. Maria's pamphlets and the manner in which she realized her lunar rosary, from study to practice to magical experience to creation, is a perfect example of how informed practice can lead to the objective reification of otherwise mystical or spiritually inspired experiences. There are few better examples of such reified magic in print at the moment, And I think it's proof that we need to reevaluate the common expression UPG, or unverified personal gnosis. Once a magical object comes into physical being, the vagary of unverification and personal go out the window. And gnosis, well, is that even a term that we can apply to an operant magical result? For a start, we'd have to be Gnostics, and secondly, Maria's reification of her rosary straddles that liminal line between mystical and objective. Magic ultimately produces material and very physical change in the world. It's not simply an ecstatic spiritual state. I am also very interested in Maria's engagement with the eight names of the moon and the force which binds them in an animated being of direction, space, and time, all subjects I am absolutely fascinated by. Maria's example in this pamphlet quite perfectly illustrates how we too can engage with magic in a manner which grounds us physically within the world, while also engaging with deeply transformative spiritual experiences. If you have made it this far, then I truly thank you. We at Hadean are so grateful for your continued support. Please like, comment, and share our podcast if you can. It really helps the algorithm. Everything that you do helps the channel grow and reach more people, which supports our global authorship. It's been a really amazing year with so many fantastic guests. I'm so lucky to have this position. I can't believe that I get to do this every month. Truly, truly, I'm so grateful. Thank you all so much from the bottom of my heart for your continued support. And here's to another year. So everyone take care, and I will see you all again in the next one.